The Federal Reserve recently announced it would maintain current levels of economic stimulus instead of phasing out quantitative easing. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will weigh in on what this means for our finances on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, some advice on why you might want to hold on to that so-called unneeded life insurance policy, and more on the entertainment equipment you might want to consider if you want to pull the plug on cable TV. And if you have a personal finance question, we would love to hear that too. Our lines are open for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
I want to thank my husband, Kevin, for doing something that I didn't even know he was going to
do. We're on the air right now, Joy.
It has to do with a beneficiary on a 401k, okay?
Okay, fair
very,
enough.
Very sexy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I didn't even know this. He said that I was not listed as beneficiary on the 401k, and he put me down. So I want to thank him very much for that.
So how long have the two of you been together?
27 years.
Okay, so he was just in his – this was a test run, a 27-year test run that he was just trying to see if, you know, this was for real.
Last, yeah.
And if he wanted to get you to receive all of his many rewards if he were to predecease you, as they say. So, yeah, good for you, Joy. You hung in there, and now you got your payoff.
I made it. But I think he thought I was on there. But our financial advisor told us, hey, check these things out. You're not always there.
And that's a very good idea.
That's what happened. So, anyway, I just wanted to thank Rob for doing that. And also just remind anybody listening that you might want to check your 401k and other policies like that, too. But I know that we were going to talk a little bit about the Fed to start off, Kevin, and you say along with lowering interest rates, the Fed has injected something else into our economic and investment climate. What would that be?
Yes, they've injected a ton of cash by buying bonds over the last 5 years. And just recently, they've ramped up the drama, uncertainty, and instability that they're putting into the economic and investment climate. The Fed's role is, by definition, to maintain stable prices and full employment. And as part of that, one of their tools is to buy securities in the open market, typically treasuries, and in the last few years, mortgage securities, which in effect lowers interest rates, hopefully gets the economy stimulated, and helps preserve the financial system as it is so we can all keep doing all the things we want to do. But they've done this for a long time. And back in the summer, earlier in the summer, they said, hey, we're going to probably slow down on this a little bit. We've done it for a long time. Looks like the economy is at least stabilized and maybe improving a little bit. So we're going to just dial this back just a wee bit. And then last week on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said, you know what? We're not going to do that just yet.
Never mind. So why didn't they stick with the original plan?
Well, there were several reasons, some of which were there were some stagnant economic indicators that came out that just said, you know what, things are okay, they're not a disaster, but they're just not getting much better. But because of his comments, and people who are dumb enough to pay attention to this stuff always parse through every word that he says to try to read some hidden meaning to it. But he actually did make kind of a less opaque comment about the upcoming fight over the debt ceiling and a potential government shutdown and what that might mean to the overall economy, and said we can't, you know, start pulling the safety net back just yet.
So what's been the general reaction to this?
There was celebration at first. Asset prices rose, stocks neared all-time highs, bond prices went up, gold went up, just about everything went up for one day. And then over the next few days, prices returned back to the level, especially there were some comments by some of the other Federal Reserve governors who said, you know, yeah, we're not going to do it right now, but we're probably going to do it in the near term here. And that to help temper some of the enthusiasm about the Fed backing away slowly.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's your response?
Well, if the goal is to help the economy, it's a lot of money for something that's really not working very well. People are conscious of prices rising and inflation for stuff that they buy a lot of, like food, for instance. And some of that is the result of the Federal Reserve's policies. And really, no one has been rewarded for this directly and wholly unless they are a risk-taking investor and a big bank. And so many times the definition is both of those things, of a single entity. Safe investors, pensions, insurers, normal banks that just, you know, are community banks, credit unions, et cetera, that just do lending and take deposits and make loans, et cetera, those have not been helped by the lower interest rates and have actually been hurt by it in many cases. And what is happening now, as we're seeing with asset prices, is these artificially lowered interest rates are blowing another bubble up in all different kinds of asset classes. And once the bubble burst, which bubbles do eventually burst. They don't slow down and dissipate. They burst. When they burst, there'll be a much bigger mess to clean up. It will be the same kind of catastrophe that we had in 2008. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen 10 years from now. But at some point, too much speculation leads to a pop, and the pop aftermath is usually very painful and very messy.
So you're saying sooner or later?
Yeah, sooner or later. It's just a matter of time. The economy doesn't have enough organic strength to grow and stand on its own. And actually, one of the things that was a little frightening for the Fed, I think, is when they just announced that maybe we might possibly ease back just a little bit on the support, bond prices went down a lot. And a lot of people who thought they were in very safe bond funds and income-producing investment, the value of those went down quite a bit, in some cases 5 or 10% over a matter of a few weeks. And so if this is just the talk of a hint of a withdrawal can cause that to happen, imagine what will happen if they actually have to pull away wholly or part way.
Kevin, I'm wondering where is one of the bubbles that's going to burst?
Well, bubbles in terms of speculative assets are pretty high right now. Some of the stock prices are generally near all-time highs for many different asset classes within the stock market realm. And it's not that they'll drop immediately, but we're generally closer to the highs than we are to the lows. And so some people see that happening and say, I have to get on board. I'm not getting any return in my personal investments, in my safe accounts, my CDs, whatever. I'm going to jump on board the stock market because that's breaking new highs. And typically buying closer to the highs rather than the lows is a good way to get hurt in the long run.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services that we discuss are suitable for every investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. So with that being said, what's your question for Kevin? Do you have a money matter that is on your mind, a personal finance dilemma or concern? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag. A listener named Bob says, my brother passed away this summer and had me as beneficiary to a life insurance policy. He once told me he wanted to make sure his grandchildren were taken care of. I'd like to start a savings account for his three grandchildren, ages 13 to 8. They will each get about $3,000 to start. Should I put the money in a 529? And can I be the guardian of it, Kevin?
Well, in the absence of false praise, we'll still take this question.
Yes.
Because it's a noble, sentimental gesture. Anyone can set up a 529 account, that's a college savings account, for any other person and remain the owner of the account, put the other person down as a beneficiary. And the beneficiary can technically be changed at any time. And then what happens is within that account, there are investments that the owner can choose from, kind of like a roster of 401k type investments, mutual funds, bond funds, stock funds, asset allocation funds, and sometimes even CDs. The growth on the 529 account, if there is any, is deferred from taxation. And then if you pull the money out and match it to qualified higher education expenses, and the definition of qualified is pretty loose, so it's likely to be usable by these kids at some point if they go to school, it's tax-free.
So would this work, or how would this work in Bob's situation?
Well, what he would probably want to do is establish three separate 529 accounts with Bob as the owner of each one. And he might want to set these up with what's known as a successor owner, meaning that he might want to have the kid's parents be the owner of the account. If something should happen to him, then the money goes directly to the ownership of the parents of it. And quite frankly, when people set these things up for their own kids or someone else, they don't even have to tell the beneficiaries really that the accounts actually exist in the first place.
So if Bob's in charge, what happens when the kids need the money for college?
What happens is it's a fairly odd and usually innocuous situation. The expenses are incurred by the family, and he can have a check sent directly to the school, but the school sometimes treat those distributions differently, and that might affect their need-based financial aid. So a better way to do it is have the parents pay for any expenses incurred by the kids that they can, and then have Bob withdraw money from the 529 plan and reimburse the parents with those funds. And he should get receipts for those expenses, because where this comes into play for the IRS and the tax advantages is if Bob is ever audited, the IRS might say, hey, we see you took a distribution from a 529 account. You didn't pay taxes on the earnings. Where were the expenses you used to match up with that? And that's really the only place that this can come into play where he could be hurt by it down the road.
So what happens if the grandkids don't need the money for college?
It's still Bob's money, in theory. He can spend it on himself if he puts it into a 529 and takes it back out again. He only owes taxes and penalties on the earnings. And for that matter, he can even give it to the kids directly. If they say, hey, I'd like to buy a car with this money, is that okay? Or I'd like to start a business or buy a house instead of going to school. They can pull the money out of the 529, and all he'll owe is taxes and penalties on the distribution. So let's say he puts $3,000 in, and over time it grows to $4,000, and then he pulls it out and either uses it for himself or some other non-qualified expense. He'll only owe about $300 in taxes and penalties on that $4,000 total withdrawal, and he would have probably owed taxes on that at some point anyway had he invested it in a normal mutual fund.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If we don't get to your email today, we might use it for a future On Your Money email bag segment. Maddie in Greendale is with us. Hi, Maddie. You're on the air.
Hello. My question is, what do I do with a $10,000 gift, cash gift that I'm receiving? I am not sure what's the best way to handle it without having that be part of my taxable income. I did think about putting a chunk of it in my son's 529, plan, but I'm not sure what to do with it.
Great question, Maddie. Good news for you. The Wisconsin Public Radio pledge drive comes up in 2 weeks, I believe. And so I think $10,000 gets you to the bronze level on them. Is this a gift from a relative? How, if you don't mind me asking, what's the source of the funds?
It's a gift from my parents, my father.
From your mother. Okay. The good news for you and everybody else involved is that your mother can give you and anyone else she likes up to $14,000 in a single calendar year. And there are no tax implications for that whatsoever for any of you. It's not income. It's not a service you perform for her or anything, right?
Right.
Okay. If it's under $14,000 in a calendar year, there are no taxes, and you don't even have to file a gift tax return. Neither one of you do. So there's no taxes for it. It's just like that card in Monopoly where you get a windfall and you get to just keep the money, and there's no issues with it at all.
That's great news. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Maddie. You can show your appreciation in our upcoming pledge drive if you want to as well. So, Kevin, we are going to be in our pledge drive coming up in October, and I know you put together a special freemium or thank you gift that is – tell us about it.
Well, it's 50 ways to save at least $50. It's one of our most popular On Your Money mini money booklets, and – basically, the theory is you donate some money. $50 would be nice, but at any dollar amount whatsoever, when you pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio, you not only get our undying gratitude, but you also get a copy of this sent to you right away. And chances are you're going to go through this and find savings that you either weren't thinking about or weren't aware of that will save you at least the amount of money that you donated to Wisconsin Public Radio. And because this October is the 10th anniversary of the first airing of On Your Money on Wisconsin Public Radio, we are including 10 extra ways to save at least $50. So follow me here. It's 60 ways to save at least $50. And all of the tips that we've used in the past on the show are all put in here. And we even have some that we've never used before. And, you know, I look on the web a lot of times for information that we're going to put together for the show. And sometimes I find these 64 ways to save, 82 ways to save, 100 ways to save. And I think, oh, good. You know, maybe there's some good ideas I can pass along to the listeners here. I am blown away with just how lame these things are compared to the 50 ways to save $50. They're things that, you know, they save things like, try not to spend so much money at the grocery store. Well, that's really helpful. Thanks a lot. That never occurred to me. And now that I know about it, lo and behold, I'm going to retire and send my kids to Ivy League schools.
And yours are not lame at all.
And, well, some of them are. Some of them are less lame than others. Let's just put it that way.
Well, that will be the 50 ways to save, or maybe 60 ways to save, for your gift during our pledge drive. By the way, we are going to be live on Sunday, October 13th, from 7 until 8 a.m. This show is usually live on Tuesday at this time. We repeat a rebroadcast of it on Sunday mornings from 7 until 8. So we will be live, though, on Sunday for our pledge drive, the first day on October 13th. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question for Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner. You can also email us on yourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money, you can make a splash.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, who is here to answer your personal finance questions, offering you some information and advice on your money. 1-800-642-1234 is our number, and we have an open line for you. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. George in Madison is with us now. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Really enjoy your show, Joy and Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Two questions. You probably covered these before. Maybe I missed them because I think they're pretty elementary. But just inherited enough money through my mom's passing last spring that gives us enough to pay off our mortgage. And the question is, how do you determine based on a 5% APR and probably another? Gosh, we refinanced about three or four years ago. How to determine whether that's the right financial decision, and then, you know, versus investing it or just keeping it in cash to help take care of college expenses 10 years down the road for my kid. The second question is, you know, related question regarding stock. We inherited a substantial amount of stock. Do you sell it? Do you hold it? Tax implications and all that.
Okay, well, I'm sorry for your mother's passing, George. I'm glad that, however, that it has so far put you in a place where you can boost up your financial security. And it's a good question, and it deserves revisiting, so I'm glad you brought it up.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. She led a long, wonderful life up to the end. I died at almost 93 years old, driving every day up to that point. So, mixed blessing, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in the future here. I've had some good theories from experts on that situation. Okay, let's get to your situation. Are you and or your wife working outside the home?
I am. She's a stay-at-home.
Okay. Are you maxing out your contributions to your at-work retirement plan?
There's not much to it, and yes.
Okay. I don't mean maxing them out in terms of how much you can do, in terms of how much you're legally allowed to do.
You know, I work for a small company, and we really just have an annual contribution that we fund our own IRAs with.
Okay.
So it's, you know, around $1,000 a year. That's about it, and that goes in every year. It's almost like a holiday bonus, but it has to go to an IRA. And so we do that. I don't think we're putting as much into the IRA as we could as a family, however.
Okay, that's a point. You're answering all of your own questions here, George. I'm getting a little disturbed about it, about my margin of expertise over the listeners here. What I would do is do exactly what you just alluded to, which is max out your family contribution to that, just by making IRA contributions to yourself, ramping up what you can do, and then maybe making it on behalf of your wife, spousal IRA contributions. Depending on your tax bracket, you're probably going to save yourself about 10 to 20% of whatever you put into that those IRAs in taxes. So if you can get, let's say, $10,000 more into those IRAs, you are going to probably save about $1,000 to $2,000 in taxes each year. All right. And
right.
because
okay.
your mother, was this your birth mother?
Yes.
Okay. She lived a very long time, had a very long retirement. You are probably likely to do the same. That means you need to be doing whatever you can to save for the retirement. So that's the first place I would go with the money. The second thing.
So in other words, hold a certain amount so that we can continue to fund that, because obviously $10,000 each is a one, annual contribution.
Sure. I would put.
We can save as much as that so that we can plan for the next, 15, 20 years until retirement. To fund that every year, is that sort
absolutely?
Of
if you
you're talking about a one-time shot, okay.
No. Let's say it's $100,000, and let's just say, out of curiosity, that you can save $10,000 per year in a pre-tax retirement plan. I would put the $100,000 into 10 different CDs over 10 years, and then every year when the $10,000 came due, use that money to fund the tax-deductible IRAs for yourselves. And
Okay.
That's a smarter use of the money anyway. And now you also mentioned you have kids coming up for college, correct?
Right, probably in about 10 years. Yeah,
okay.
9 or 10 years.
Same thing with that. Another good reason to not pay off a mortgage any sooner than you have to is that money is potentially tax deductible, at least on the interest, and it's a 25 or 30 year loan. You will probably never get lending terms that good if you need to borrow money for your kids' college expenses. So you definitely want to build up that savings as well to also use that for future college expenses that aren't covered by financial aid or any other loans that are subsidized that you might be able to get. So no, do not pay off the mortgage any quicker than you used to. Save for retirement and then keep the money set aside, not just for college, but also other emergencies so that you have it there. It's very difficult to get a new mortgage or to borrow against your house if by definition you need that money. So I'd much rather have you pay a little bit in interest, save some money in taxes with the distributions, and boost your liquidity up so that you've got a new safety net underneath you with the form of these funds. And I'm guessing that's probably what your mother would want as well.
George, thank you so much for the call, and good luck to you. Anne in Watertown emails, I'm planning on retiring in about 12 years. I have three 401ks that I have left with old employers. What should I do with them?
Well, I would take a good look at them and try to get some kind of analysis of those 401ks done, and if they're in the right place, and if she's kind of on the right path towards using them for retirement. And she can, of course, go to a financial advisor, investment firm, insurance company, bank, credit union, whatever. But you can also call a place like Vanguard, Schwab, and Fidelity, and TD Ameritrade. And those outfits do a lot more now than they did, say, 10 or 20 years ago for someone in Ann's situation. And it's usually very low cost, if there is any cost to it at all, depending on her situation. And then once she finds a company she likes and is comfortable with, she may want to just consolidate those 401ks into an IRA so that she has more control over it. However, there are some advantages to keeping money in a 401k, not so much when it comes to an investment situation, although that can be the case. It's more so about the unique mechanics of it. Sometimes 401k money is more accessible when it's held, even at an old employer, than it is when an IRA, especially if she thinks she's going to need that money before turning 59 and a half. So she may want to get to know the ins and outs of each 401k's specific plan documents so that she knows if she can, say, borrow against it, or if she can tap it early without a penalty but only pay taxes on it, or if there's a unique investment in those 401ks that she can't duplicate on her own. So she really needs to get some analysis of that rather than just blindly saying, you know what, I'm just going to all pull this into one and damn the torpedoes.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's time now for Smart Assets. It's still September, so it's still National Life Insurance Month. And today we're going to talk about that unneeded insurance policy. Kevin, why might we want to hang on to an unneeded insurance policy?
Well, people often let a good insurance policy go to waste, especially if it's one that was purchased a long time ago and has kind of seasoned and matured. And a lot of people look at this and say, you know what, our life has changed so much. We don't have kids at home anymore. Or we have so much money that this life insurance death benefit really isn't going to be that valuable to us. Or we have so little money and so little income, we really can't afford these premiums anymore. And I understand those sentiments, but there are three big reasons you might want to hang on to that policy before you just let it lapse.
Okay, what's the first big reason?
Well, you might still need it. If you are in a married couple and one of you passes away, especially in retirement, you will lose the smaller of your Social Security checks when that person passes away. And maybe, depending on how your pension is set up, if you do have a pension, you might lose that pension check as well, or it might drop. And what I found in 25 years of doing this is when the spouse passes away, the expenses usually don't drop by as much as the lost income from Social Security or maybe a pension. Plus, along the way to through retirement, you might incur health care or long-term care costs that you have to pay out of pocket. And sometimes the proceeds from that life insurance policy can help replenish money spent on that care at some point so that the surviving spouse has more to live on.
Okay, but what if those aren't our concerns?
Someone else actually might benefit from the policy proceeds. It might be a family member who say, hey, no offense, that's a good policy, and we don't want you to do anything that you wouldn't do, but rather than let it lapse, we'd like to receive the proceeds from that at some point, and especially since it's tax-free money. And also, charities might be interested in that policy as well, and there are some tax advantages to donating a life insurance policy to a qualified charity. We'll talk about that in a couple weeks during our pledge drive. And another thing that a life insurance policy does for people while they're alive is if they do have some of those needs, like saying, gee, I'd like to provide for family members or friends or whatever when I die, or I might have a charity in mind, knowing that that policy is in place will allow you to spend a little bit more, saying, you know what, even if there's no money left when I'm gone, as long as this policy's there, somebody or some organization I care about will get that money. And there are even instances where I've seen where people in that situation say, hey, I've got this life insurance policy, you're the beneficiary, I don't want it anymore. If you want it in place, you want to pay the premium so that it comes to you if and when I go.
Okay, good. So what's the last big reason to keep an unneeded life insurance policy?
It might be a good investment. Not as good as the salespeople say it is usually, but it's still pretty good, especially if it is an older cash value life insurance policy or even a term policy that you have a lot of years left on. The Consumer Federation is a nonprofit that helps consumers figure things out like this, and they've analyzed a lot of policies. And they've said that generally, if you have a cash value policy that you've had for more than 20 years, the cost of that policy is well worth not only the investments, but potentially the death benefit as well. And especially if you weigh out what the premiums are versus your life expectancy, you might find that the death benefit will far exceed what you're going to pay in premiums. And finally, we've had this from several callers in the last few weeks. They want to get rid of these policies. And when we ask them, say, well, what are you getting in a fixed rate of return on this? They say, that's not much. It's 3 or 4%. Well, relative to the last 30 years, that's not much. But relative to 2013, that's a great rate of return on a fairly safe investment. It's not as safe as a CD, but it's still pretty safe. And 3 or 4% on a fixed rate policy is pretty good. And even if it's not a fixed rate policy, there are several tax advantages to a cash value policy that is matured along with the death benefits. So generally think twice before getting rid of it.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Coming up on Your Money, we will continue our series on how and why you might want to cut the cable TV cord. That's coming up as On Your Money continues. Now to more of your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Heidi in Two Rivers. Hi, Heidi.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead with your question.
Hello. Right now, are you there?
Yes, go ahead with your question.
Oh, right. Right now, we invest automatically into our son's ESA program, and I'm wondering if we should switch that to, is it the 529 college savings? Right now, we're doing the education savings account. And I'm wondering if we should just continue with that or if we should switch it to the, is it the 529?
Yep, you're right. What? How did you get started in the ESA account, Heidi?
I'm sorry, what was that?
How did you get started using that ESA account in the first place?
Oh, we do it through Vanguard.
Okay.
And we just, we invest under $2,000 a year for each of those kids, so we just went with the ESA at the time.
Yeah, my preference is to use the 529 account, and it depends a little bit on the structure of the account you currently have, but I'm guessing you can probably roll that ESA tax-free into a 529 account. The 529 account is a lot more flexible, and it gives you a lot larger potential dollar investment as well. And I just like the ESAs were created before the 529 accounts, and it was a good idea for the time, but now the 529s are much better. And if you call Vanguard, they're usually happy to help you do the paperwork in terms of establishing a new 529 account if possible, and then rolling the money from the ESA into the 529 if you'd like to do that.
Thanks for the call, Heidi. Good luck. Will in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Will. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The issue I'm dealing with is my wife and I have gotten ourselves into a tremendous amount of credit card debt. And our current plan is, once my wife turns 59 and a half, we're going to take a huge chunk of money out of either the 401k or the IRAs to get rid of all this credit card debt. But the concern is that's going to increase our annual income where, you know, taxes might become an issue. Are we on the right track there?
Yeah, Will, you've got a good handle on that. And by the way, the fact that you're actually addressing this problem is a great sign. There are two big issues, one of which you addressed already, is that you're going to get clobbered on taxes, especially, are you still both working outside the home?
Yes.
Okay. If you make more than, say, about $90,000 between the two of you, you're probably going to be taxed at the 25% federal rate when you pull that money out of the 401k or IRA. And so what I'd rather you do, in a smarter way to do this, and I'm okay with you doing it this way, but the smarter way to do it is pull enough out every single year to hopefully stay under that 25% federal income tax bracket. And that line, Will, is on it's line 43 of your 1040. And the figure for 2013 is $72,500. If you can stay under that, you'll only pay 15% federal taxes on whatever you're pulling out of it. And I'm guessing those credit cards, some of them probably have close to 15% interest, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So now, if you can't,
if we're already over 72, it's not a concern then?
Oh, it is a concern. It means that you'll probably lose, you know, anywhere from 25 to 35% of the 401k money to taxes. Now, some people would say, hey, I'd rather pay that big chunk up front rather than pay 10 or 15% or more in interest over however many years. So I can see that being an option. And I'm okay with that. If you say, I just want to be done with this, have it over and out, especially if you address my second concern, is which if you've not only quantified but eliminated or at least reduced the behaviors that got you into the situation in the first place. If you said, yeah, we know the problem, we feel like we've got a handle on it now, and we're not going to do this again unless we have a huge, horrible emergency, then I would say, okay, go ahead, take it out, pay the taxes on it, be done with it. But maybe at least do some of it this year in 2013, and then wait till next year in 2014 to pull the other half of it out. So at least you spread the tax bill out over 2 years. And then finally, I'm guessing you're making some pretty big payments on those cards right now, right?
Yes. In fact, we have a year and a half to get into that mindset. Wife won't be 59 for another year and a half.
Okay. And again, I'm saying this just to explore all your options. I'm not necessarily recommending this. Have you checked your 401ks to see if you have an option to borrow against the assets?
I guess not borrow.
Okay, that's a much cheaper solution than pulling money directly out of it and taking a distribution from it. So at least check in. And sometimes if you can't pull back on the credit card debt and the spending via the credit card, and then you take money from a 401k loan, that can only compound the problem. But otherwise, if you feel like I said, you got a handle on it, it may be smarter to get a loan from the 401k rather than taking an actual taxable distribution from it right now.
Because a loan wouldn't up our annual income, I guess.
Yeah, nope, it's generally not taxable. Generally, you can only get $50,000, and you do have to pay the loan back if your employment is terminated, usually. But for the time being, that's probably a better way to go.
Hope that helps, Will. Good luck to you. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
My mama told me you better shop around.
So as part of our series on how to spend less and get more television programs, we are covering how and why you might want to consider cutting the cable cord. And Kevin, what's this week's lesson?
This week's lesson, and I've survived a lot of car bombing attempts from the good people in the cable and the satellite industry so far. So I'm running scared, but I'm undaunted. We're going to talk about what you need to be cable-free. We've already discussed how to reduce your cable bill or get a more efficient one. Now we're going to talk about you've already cut the cord, but you still want the programming. And the trend is that you will be with the hipsters on this one, because one of the first times ever this year, there was a net loss of cable and dish subscribers in the country. And it's because, you know, although the alternative is not free, it's much less expensive, and you may even get a wider selection of shows than what you get from your cable or dish provider right now.
I want to be a hipster. Where do I start?
You have a need for speed, internet speed, that is. You not only have to have internet access, unless you can get a really good connection from your neighbor's Wi-Fi, you have to have internet access, and the higher the speed, the better the reception and broadcasting quality will be. And sadly, you're probably going to get that either from your telephone company, but maybe your cable or even your dish provider. You still have to pay, but even the higher levels of speed generally are about $30 a month or so as a base price, depending on what other packages you have in it. And again, as we've discussed before, you can throw either Hulu or Netflix or Amazon Prime or something on there for maybe $8 to $10 a month each, and a total of those for maybe about $20 to $25 each on top of the Wi-Fi and the internet cost.
And the cable TV company is going to say, sure, I'll give you internet even though you just canceled me?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a reason they laid all this fiber and cable for the internet. They saw this coming a long time ago and wanted to make sure that they didn't just go into the wind with buggy manufacturers.
So then what?
You need that Wi-Fi router. That's about $30 to $50. And make sure that before you go through all this, you understand that you can put the router close enough to the source of the cable so that you can also have it get close enough to the receptacle that you need by your TV. So do some testing to make sure that, you know, your house isn't, your mansion isn't so big that the signal can't get all the way from the source of the Wi-Fi to your television.
So that's it then?
Nope. You still need a device to receive the signal from Wi-Fi. And one of the easiest things to do and the most cost-effective is just to buy a new DVD player. And many of them are already web-enabled. So the minute that you turn it on, they not only search for the Wi-Fi signal, but gather that. And then they also have direct links already to programs like Amazon Prime, Hulu, Vudu, which is Walmart's offering. Target's coming out with a similar one, too, so they can go right to it. If you were dumb enough to buy your kid an Xbox like I was a few years ago, that also can serve as a way to get movies from the web or TV shows to your TV. The Roku little device and Google have these little dongles that come along with well that are about $25 or $30 or so. And then Apple TV, if you're a big Apple fan and already have an Apple platform, this is a pretty good way to go, although it's not as cost-effective, and it doesn't have quite the quality of some of the other solutions.
Boy, anything else that we need then?
You need a screen to watch it. And obviously, the television works best. And in some of them, they have an HDMI port in there so that you can get a cable directly to that. If you do have the option of putting your web directly into that, and then you may not need a Wi-Fi. Your computer screen, if you've got a nice enough screen, a comfortable place to sit. But also keep in mind that a tablet can serve as a screen just as well. And if you are younger than you and me and a lot of the other people listening, your eyes are probably still good enough where it's still possible to watch a TV show or a movie on your smartphone screen.
Yes. So am I really going to be spending less and getting more TV this way?
That's a good question. You will definitely be getting more TV and more of a selection from all those. In terms of less, if you're really on the big channels, what really adds up to the cost for cable is the DVR and the unit for serving that. It's a very useful device. I have two of those in our house, and I like them, but they're very expensive, and that's how the bill quickly gets over, you know, $200 or $300 total once you bundle it all in with your telecom and other television services and internet. But if you just say, yeah, I don't need the DVR, I'm going to use the TV or the web as my DVR, this is a much more affordable way to go.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. And if you have a question for Kevin, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Two more of your phone calls now. Tom in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Tom. What's your question for Kevin?
Hey, Kevin, thanks again. You have a wonderful show. You've helped out in the past. A couple months ago, I called in about my daughter who is purchasing a home for the first time. She's put that a little bit on a pause, and she's now looking at condos. I'm wondering if you have any advice for a first-time buyer in purchasing a condo.
Wow. A call from a second-time caller regarding a first-time home buyer. This is, my mind is bending now as we speak. Tom, What was the motivation from switching for her?
The home that she was looking at, she did put in an offer to purchase it, and somebody else came in with a higher offer, and that home disappeared. Since then, she has come up with a kind of a friend of a friend that's helping her in this process, looking at the condo. Advice from folks is, you know, condos may or may not be the best purchase at this point in time with some of the association issues that are coming on with regards to home ownership versus renters coming into the complexes. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to reach out to Kevin. He always gives great advice, and maybe we can get another golden nugget here.
Ooh, wonderful.
You're correct on all accounts. The condo is exactly what you're hearing, in that if it's the right place and you want to be, you know, in a specific area and there aren't a lot of single-family homes, obviously you have to go with a condo. But condos have a lot of the negatives of home ownership with not very many of the positives of it. You're sharing walls, you're sharing space, and worst of all, as you mentioned, you're sharing expenses for the building. And the less attractive the building comes, the more the expenses go up and vice versa. And then the harder it is, of course, to sell the condo. Plus, you have the condo fees over which you have no control. You can't negotiate whom you're going to hire to shovel or to do the lawn or whatever. You're restricted over what you can do with it. And I get this, especially for a first-time home buyer. She sees interest rates going up and says, gosh, you know, I want to get in. I've always wanted to own a house. I can do it. I missed out on this other one, and now I can get this condo. My feeling is that even that this is probably not going to be a 30-year proposition for her. And if and when she does go to sell it, she will probably not make money on it. If she does, she won't make a whole lot. And so I would much rather have her just wait. And if she is worried about interest rates rising, keep in mind that as interest rates rise, housing prices fall. And so the more interest rates rise, the better it is for her for actually buying the house, because she can probably get a better price if she waits 6 months or a year. So I'd really much rather have her, if she has her heart set on a single family home or an individual house, I'd much rather have her wait rather than buying a condo.
Very good.
All right, Tom, thanks, and good luck to you and your daughter. Milagros is with us in Kenosha. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a longtime listener. and thank you for taking my call. I kind of have a feeling that I know what Kevin's going to say, but I just wanted to double check. We're finishing up the construction of our home, and we're at the point where we would convert the construction loan into a like 30-year fixed loan. So since the rates have gone up, we've kind of been looking at other options, because the payments basically have probably gone up like $300 to $500 for us per month. We put 10% down, so we still have to pay PMO. And there's this other option where it's like, if we don't do anything with the loan, it automatically rolls into a one-year ARM, which is at like 1.9%, and has kind of stayed there for quite a while. And then we wouldn't have to pay PMO or do another application. So what makes that attractive to us is PMI. What makes that attractive is that we wouldn't have to pay PMI, and we wouldn't have to, you know, deal with the with the application process, and the payments would be like $600 less a month, and we wanted to build up more of our emergency fund since we've been using so much money for this home.
Mm-hmm. All right, Milagros, you really have a great handle on the situation. Let's see if we can close the loop on my obsolescence, and you tell me what I'm going to say.
I think you're going to say go with the 30-year loan.
You are correct. Thanks for calling. No. Let me tell you why you're correct. You are correct because by very definition of what you said, and I get what you're saying. I get that you're saying that, you know, this has cost more than we thought it would, and we've used up all of our savings. We really just want to get into this place, and man, if we could keep this payment as low as possible for the time being, it would really help us build up this money. I get all that. Here's the problem with that. If by definition you're short on cash now when interest rates are very low, if and when interest rates rise, and they will rise, Milagros, you're going to stay in this home for quite a while, you plan on it, I bet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if and when they do rise, you're going to be caught between a rock and a hard place because you're going to watch your payment go up a lot, but you're also going to see mortgage rates higher than even what they are right now. And here's what I think is going to happen. If you get the 30-year mortgage, which you should, and pay the PMI, that's fine. Keep as much cash on hand. So you just want to make the mortgage payment every single month so you can stay in this really great new house and then figure out where the next mortgage payment is going to come from within 30 days. So I really want you to concentrate on just making the payment but having it be fixed so you have total control over it on the next 360 months if you get the 30-year. What interest rate are you being quoted right now on this for the 30-year fixed?
4.75.
Okay. Up until about 2.5 years ago, hundreds of millions of American homeowners would have given their eye teeth and their firstborn to get that rate on a 30-year mortgage. And I'm guessing within a year or two, many more people will also be willing to make that same sacrifice. Sometimes they just want to get rid of the firstborn. They don't care about the mortgage rate. But you will be so happy in the future at some point when interest rates rise past that. And if I'm wrong and interest rates, you know, don't go up at all, well, in 2 or 3 years, you're going to be in better shape financially. You are going to be have more equity established in your home, hopefully, and you'll be able to go back to the bank and say, hey, we see that we can now get a 3.75% rate mortgage on that. But if you miss out on this 4.75% and rates don't go back down to it again, you will never be able to go back and get it. And the higher the interest rates go on the adjustable rate, the higher it is for you to not only make the payment, but also bite the bullet and switch over to a fixed rate. So please get the 30-year fixed rate. Yes, it's a big cash crunch for the time being, but you'll be much happier in the long run.
Thank you, Milagros, for the call. Well, we're at the end of the hour. Kevin, what is the website of the week?
We mentioned the Consumer Federation of America, a great nonprofit. They have a neat service called EvaluateLifeInsurance.org, EvaluateLifeInsurance.org, where if you want to know if a new or existing policy is a good deal, you send the policy information in. It's completely confidential, and for about $50 or so, they'll have a CFA analyze it and give you a report on what the actual investment rate is. So if you're being sold this cash value insurance or you have one, you want to know what to do with it and pay a small price, EvaluateLifeInsurance.org, and we'll have that website up at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. And time now for 4 more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and the managing member of McKinley Money LLC. With us every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Thank you to producers, directors, Bill Martins, and Christy Taylor. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.